Snetter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer Snetter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to another Nailers Natter, and this week I'm in conversation with Matt Pinkett, who is the co-author of the vital book with Mark Roberts, Boys Don't Try. Also on the podcast this week we have Podcast Pedagogy, in which I review What They Didn't Teach Me on My PGCE by Sarah Mullin, which is an absolute blockbuster of a book, but more of that later on. So back to Boys Don't Try and the interview with Matt, and this is probably one of the most open and honest interviews I've ever had the pleasure to record in the approaching 50 Nailers Natters that we've done. And I feel extremely passionate about the book and its themes, and Matt really inspired me to share parts of my experience of the book's themes. So Boys Don't Try examines the research around key topics such as anxiety and achievement, behaviour and bullying, schoolwork and self-esteem. And Mark and Matt offer us ways to avoid problematic behaviour and how to address this by boys, and highlights key areas of pastoral care. And they also expose how popular approaches to engaging boys are at best misguided and at worst damaging. So Matt is a fantastic guest. He's eloquent, he's knowledgeable, and he's got lots of experience that are richly rooted in the classroom. So I'm sure that you will enjoy this. So without further ado, over to my interview with Matt Pinkett on Boys Don't Try. Okay, so hi, Matt, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, hello.
And thanks for doing this in the Christmas holidays. So there'll be a long distant memory by the time this comes out, but we are just at the end, at the point where you start to discover where your school stuff is, where all that marking in the back of your car hasn't been touched, and that sort of period. So thanks for joining us.
That's it. No worries. Looking forward to it.
Okay, so as we always start, we're just going to give a gentle introduction. So I'm sure that listeners are very much aware of your work, and particularly the book is what we're going to be talking about tonight. But if you could just give us a little bit of an introduction about you and your career to this point.
Yeah, okay. So I guess I came in kind of late into teaching. So 2012 I started. I think I was about 20, 26 at the time. And what did I do? I did GTP there. I always wanted to teach. I wanted to teach from, I don't know, like 13 years old, maybe younger, 12 years old. But then I went to university. I was just sick of university. I didn't want to do any more learning. So I got my degree, and then I just sacked it all off. But lucky enough, I found myself in a series of jobs I didn't enjoy, and then I saw an advert for the graduate teacher program. It was the last year they were doing it, so by that time I was 26. I had a flat and all the rest of it I had to pay for, so I couldn't really afford to go back to uni. But this graduate teacher program was like a paid placement, so I did a year there, and I stayed at the school for 4 years after that. Then I moved to another school called King's College in Guildford, where I was head of English. That's an amazing place. I'll always be proud of everything that the students and the teachers did there. And then in September just gone, I joined the RISE school in Felton, which is a special school for autistic pupils. And I'm assistant head of teaching, learning and assessment there.
Brilliant, brilliant. So lots to talk about there.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is, the focus really of the podcast is going to be about your book. So, I mean, it's a fantastic book, and it's something that we've read quite a lot. When I was at the research school, we read quite a lot of that, because a lot of the stuff that you're talking about there is steeped in a lot of research and in practical application, which is kind of the stuff that we were trying to do. So the book in question is, of course, Boys Don't Try. So just tell us a little bit about the genesis of the book and how it started with your blog, Balance for Boys.
Balance for Boys, yeah. So Balance for Boys is the title of a blog post I wrote, in which I said some pretty awful stuff. I said some good stuff in there as well, I think. I mean, it's still on my blog. I haven't taken it down, despite the fact that I'm embarrassed by some of the stuff that's in there. I think it's important that I kind of have this record of like how far I've come in my attitudes towards gender and gender and schooling. But anyway, in this blog post entitled "Balance for Boys," I said that English is over feminized, which is ludicrous. It's so problematic, that statement. Basically, I was asked, the whole blog, I was talking about English, and I said that I think this is almost a direct quote. I said, English teachers across the country are so focused on addressing and undoing the deplorable wrongs inflicted on women in society, media and literature for centuries that they're inadvertently alienating the boys. And I kind of argued that the subject was over-feminized and as a result, boys just weren't engaging with it. And I think that's a problematic thing to say, because what it does is it suggests that the things that English are about, expression and creativity and human condition and all the rest of it suggests that those things are exclusively female, and they're not. They're human things, not female things or male things. But anyway, that blog, some of it resonated with people, and then all of a sudden I just was writing more and more stuff about boys, and kind of running parallel to the kind of stuff that I was writing about boys in education. My co-author Mark Roberts was also doing the very same. I think he was doing it a little bit better than I was, but he was doing it too. And I remember one day he just got in touch on Twitter. We've never even met before, and he was like, I like the cut of your jib or whatever. I like some of the stuff you've got to say. Do you want to maybe write a book together? And it was like this strange set of, I don't know, like coincidental circumstances, really. So Mark got in touch with me and said, do you want to write a book together one day? We can submit a proposal to loads of different publishers. And I said, yeah, let's do it. And we were just kind of tinkering around with a proposal and some rough ideas. And then another blog I wrote, I can't even remember what one it was. It might have been the Militant Tenderness one, but another blog I wrote kind of did the rounds on Twitter and Facebook and social media. And in that same week, I had two different publishers get in touch with me and saying, do you want to write a book for us? And I was like, well, it's funny you should say that, because there's a writer that's a better writer than I am, and me and him are going to write a book together. So, and then it all went from there.
Brilliant. Well, in terms of tonight, we're going to stick to your chapters, because obviously, Mark isn't here to speak about his chapters. So
yep.
If people do want a sort of a comprehensive overview of the whole book, I believe there is a podcast whose name, it's Page Practice Podcast, I think it's called. I'm pretty sure that's what it's called. And Bex, who runs that, I think they've done a podcast on the whole book. But
Yeah, they have.
And it's been a really popular one, that, as well. I know that it's a really, really good podcast. That's one that I've got on my not too frequent visits to the gym, which need to be more frequent. In fact, I was a lot of your stuff today, I was thinking, yes, I could totally agree with your thoughts today about the reason to go to the gym. But once you get past 40, that sort of stuff doesn't matter anyway. Nobody does that. No one's bothered about that. Anyway, moving it back to dragging it back to this. So your chapters start with chapter 2. In terms of disadvantaged students. So sort of two-part question here. Could you start with your definition for disadvantaged students and then tell listeners why you feel as if the education system is kind of centred on middle-class values?
Yeah, sure. So I use the term disadvantaged students rather than working-class students. It struck me that actually working-class people are doing all right, like, All of my mates are working class, and they all own two houses, each one of them. They didn't go to uni; they work in the trades and stuff like that, and they're all doing really well for themselves. Whereas I went to university, and I've got F4, you know. So that term working class is problematic. So I went with the term disadvantaged students. And actually, when I talk about disadvantaged students, I'm talking about this thing that these group of people that Mike Savage, in his book Class in the 21st Century, describes as the precariat class. The precariat class, and the precariat class is made up of those people who kind of live and work in precarious circumstances. It's the people that don't have savings, the people who, you know, whose lives are always at the mercy of somebody else. I think, you know, the people that live from one pay packet or one income support payment to the next, the people who, you know, who a landlord could say one day, actually, I'm selling up, and these people are stuck, you know, or someone that says, sorry, I can't give you the hours this month. So the precariat class of these people, whose kind of lives are always governed by other people's decisions, and governed by people who are probably richer and better off than they are. It's important to say, I think in the book about pupil premium as a kind of proxy for disadvantaged students, I realise now that actually that's a little bit problematic. Becky Allen has written a lot about this, but actually the moment you get pupil premium students, the kind of income support and the benefits and that they get actually raises their income above what you might above the threshold of the working poor. So actually in schools, I think we do need to be aware of that actually our pupil premium students aren't always the poorest students in our school. But anyway, yeah, so when I'm talking about disadvantaged students, I'm talking about those people who live, whose lives are governed by other people's decisions. And yeah, in the book, I talk about the fact that I believe that teaching is inherently a middle class profession that centres around middle class values. And you can see this. I mean, I see it. I mean, it's different for me, right? I live in Surrey. I get that. I live and I work in Surrey. But I don't know, conversations in staff room, you know, teachers talking about their weekends in the Swiss Alps. I still hear teachers using that word chav. I still see teachers looking disdainfully upon students that come in on non-uniform days wearing a tracksuit. I still see people laughing about the Jeremy Kyle show and not realising how exploitative it is, you know. Teachers talking about road bikes, you know. I mean, this is all anecdotal, and I guess it's my own... I've got my own issues there, but apart from that kind of anecdotal stuff, there was a teacher TAP survey last year in which 71% of respondents identified as middle class rather than working class or upper class. And that disappointed me. And I think I went to Twitter and I kind of expressed my disappointment. And people said, well, Matt, the fact is, you're a teacher. You earn, you know, you're the moment you earn over 30 grand, you can't legitimately call yourself. You can't legitimately call yourself working class. But to those people, I'll always say, why not? What, just because I'm now on a so-called middle class wage, I'm supposed to just reject everything I experienced prior to the time I earned that wage? I'm meant to just not talk, forget all the years of struggle, forget the people on the estate, forget all that, and now just declare myself middle class just because I earn a certain wage. I think it's disappointment in. And, you know, I see plenty of working class people. There are loads of teachers who come from working class backgrounds, and 71% of them are saying that they're now middle class. Well, I don't see so many middle class people losing everything and then going around telling the world that they're working class. It just seems a bit off to me, you know.
Listen, I absolutely do know, and I'm sat here in what could, you know, kind of be called the small study corner of the bedroom, with a picture. I've got a picture of George Orwell, which is just very, very, very apt for this kind of conversation. In terms of, I would always identify myself as working class, so I would have been one of the minority of people that you're talking about, because the reason that a lot of my family were that, you know, I mean, I did a family tree, you went back as far as I could find, and they were all miners from Wigan. I mean, there wasn't anything else.
Yeah.
But it's interesting you said that in terms of centred on middle class. And if you don't mind me just sharing one quick anecdote, I know it's not really about me, this conversation, but in a school I was in previously, we had a tannoy system for doing break times. And, you know, it was a senior leader's responsibility to read out a pre-prepared script for where pupils should go in the event of a wet break time. And I did it once, and you've probably picked up the fact that I've got a reasonably strong regional dialect, which is softening slightly now that I've moved to the, you know, slightly more affluent areas of Lytham St. Arns. You know, it's slightly softening. Mm. But I did it once, and then they wouldn't allow me to do it again. And I had a lot of mockery in the staff room around my describing of social spaces. And they said, we can't possibly have somebody with you doing that. I just thought, so that just shows you the inherent middle-class bias, which you described really, really well in that chapter.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me started on the accent thing. I'm sorry to hear that you've had to deal with that, because I've had to deal with it too. People just can't get over the way I speak. Like, I mean, I drop my T's occasionally, get over it. Oh, it's frustrating. But this middle class thing, you know, the focus on university, that kind of thing that is never said, but, you know, going on to do an apprenticeship or not going to university is failure. You know, I don't know. The problem when I talk about this is that I guess some of my own insecurities, I guess, come into play. But what is not disputable, you know, like, you know, 71% of teachers identifying as middle class, for me, that is problematic. And Diane Ray, in her book Myth Education, she put it brilliantly. She said, you know, talking about this fact that everyone, you know, I earn 30 grand now I'm middle class. The moment you come from a working class background, and you start describing your middle class, what you're really saying is that you're a somebody. And if you're a somebody, then the people you left behind all of a sudden are nobodies. Mm. And I'm uncomfortable with the fact that 71% of the teachers who are teaching our kids are saying that they are middle class, when almost certainly 71% of the population isn't middle class.
No. And it's this idea that, you know, by getting education, you then can break free from all of the previous things that you were associated with. I had this conversation with Martin Robinson that, you know, is there anything wrong with, you know, aspiring to, you know, be a person in a particular trade who likes going to the opera? Is there anything wrong with being somebody who works in a supermarket and likes the theatre? You know, education for, you know, education to be able to think the way that you want to think, rather than to get out of the dire current place that you either live or
this
work.
And the language, the semantics, is always about breaking free. It's about escaping. It's about rising up. And again, I'll quote Diane Ray again here. She says, do you know what the working class really, what they really need? They don't need to rise out of their class. They need to rise with their class, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating subject. Just continue a little bit. I just want to make my point. So I'm aware that some people might be listening to CMEs. He's letting his own personal things impose on this issue, but you know, still you hear people saying, "Oh, we've got a discount on these revision guides for you all. They're only 3 quid each. Only 3 quid for some people. 3 quid isn't only 3 quid. 3 quid is a lot of money. You know, some of the disdain that you see expressed for parents that look a certain way or speak a certain way or present themselves a certain way at parents' evening. People don't want to admit it, but it, but I feel that it's there. I mean, I think Britain is a classist society, and I think too often teachers feel that they have to present themselves as kind of impervious to all the biases that everybody else is susceptible to. But teachers are human just like everybody else. And so I think the first thing we need to consider, as with anything, any kind of inequality in our system, is actually maybe we are a little too middle class. Mm. Yeah, that's my piece on that.
No, and as you know, it's very rare that I go off in terms of offering opinions on the podcast, but I mean, it's something that really resonated with me in terms of, you know, I'm not from a family of teachers. Nobody's ever set foot in a classroom as a teacher out of anyone that I know, which also seems to be quite a rarity because most teachers seem to know other teachers or be related to other teachers or all that kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
So that, anyway, pull it back to the book. Sorry, Matt. Go on.
Yeah. I just want to say, I have resentment for people for being middle class. I don't, but I do resent a system that seems to exclude people that don't earn certain amounts of money. That's all I'll say.
Okay, so I mean, at the end of the chapters, you offer some solutions, and you talk in the final final thought of the chapter, that you say that the main thing holding back working class students is attitude. So tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that, and maybe some of the solutions that you offered for teachers, you know, around this issue.
Yeah, I think attitude to what equates to success in school. I think still in many schools, success is university attendance. And I think that's a huge problem. I think, you know, you see prospectuses, school prospectuses, in which they proudly talk about the fact that, you know, 10 of their students are now at Oxford, Cambridge, or Exeter, or something. Where's the, you know, oh, little Jimmy went on to become the best plumber in the area? You don't see it. I think our attitudes towards success, I think we need to move away from being kind of exam focused or university focused or further study focused, and actually be a bit more. In the book, I think I said we just need to be more person focused, and we need to change our attitudes towards success. And actually, success isn't going to university or going on to do, you know, academic subjects at college. Success is developing human beings that are comfortable in themselves, are happy and proud of what they choose to do. I mean, they need options, of course. But yeah, I think we need to, because you said earlier about what's wrong with somebody choosing to go into a trade and being interested in the opera. I think you're exactly right there. But I think a lot of the discourse, particularly around exam time, is about the future, and a future that involves university or higher study as a rate. And what if there is a kid in your class that does want to go and work with his dad as a landscape gardener, that feels like he can't get involved in the discussions that are happening on in class, can't talk about opera, can't talk about great works of literature or great discoveries in science, because so much of the discourse around academia is tied in with university attendance. So I think we just need to change our attitudes to what constitutes success.
Absolutely. So just moving into chapter 4 now. So in chapter 4, you talk about mental health, and you set up the chapter with an insight into how Romeo and Juliet is about male mental health. So how do you link Romeo and Juliet to 21st century Britain?
Do you know what? The connection I meant at the time was suicide. I noticed that there are a lot of parallels with the kind of things that Romeo is presenting and the kind of mental health struggles that people have today. You know, when we first see him, his father tells Benvolio that Romeo was, I can't remember the exact quote, but Romeo is locking himself away, can't get out of bed, he's keeping the curtains drawn, he's shutting out the sunlight. Now that, to me, that's what depression feels like for me and for other people. And yet, then he meets Juliet and he has these kind of manic high. And I saw parallels with bipolar there. And then he's clearly depressed and in the end he kills himself. So there are parallels, I think, with what young people and all people are experienced today in mental health, and with Romeo. Although, on the other hand, perhaps it's a poor link because, you know, unlike lots of young men today, Romeo actually speaks a lot about how he's feeling. Speaks all the time about how he's feeling. However, he is berated for doing so. Friar Lawrence tells him, thy tears are womanish. So, while he does talk a lot, he is berated for doing so. And certainly nowadays, most of the teachers I know, anyway, are trying to encourage young people to talk about how they feel. So yeah.
And what you do really, really well in all of the chapters is you go back to a real depth of research and evidence in terms of, you know, the key points. So could you outline some of the key research on suicide, anger and self-harm?
Yeah, I mean, I know it's a cliche, and I say this in the book, it's a cliche, but, you know, that 75% of suicides are young men. I'm sure everybody knows that, but that is still a dreadful statistic. What else is there? Boys in the most deprived 10% of society are twice as likely to kill themselves as those in the least deprived. Irish traveller boys are 7 times more likely to kill themselves than other boys. 24% of boys aged 14 to 16 engage in self-harm. Interestingly, the most likely way that is would be alcohol abuse, but the second most popular way, popular is a bad word, but the second most common way that boys self-harm is punching walls. 19% of self-harm in boys aged 14 to 16 is punching walls. Things like controlling their eating, 16%, over-exercising, 12%. And you know, I do know boys, when I worked in a school with a sixth form around exam time, you know, you see the boys in the gym and really, really pushing themselves in there in ways that I don't necessarily think 16, 17, 18 year old boys should be. So, there's a lot of quite heartbreaking things, and it's increasing. Suicide in young men went up 23% in 2018, 23%. And yet we're currently apparently more open about these kind of issues than we ever have been before. It's a bit of a worry.
Mm. So you followed up with some advice. So what kind of advice do you offer to school leaders?
Well, there's so much. I think we need to model emotional openness, leaders and teachers. And when I talk about emotional openness, I mean sensitivity and tenderness. You know, boys need to see men and women in positions of authority being kind and being tender and being vulnerable and being weak. I think that's key. We need to be, I think we need to be providing men to talk to as well. I'd ask, So I think in lots of pastoral teams, certainly in my experience, and also this is based off a Twitter poll I did, in lots of pastoral teams, you always have that kind of teacher who's like the homeschool liaison person, the one that's the shoulder to cry on for when kids have problems, the one that gets to know mom or dad and rings home when there's a problem. Too often these people are female, and often if there is a male on the pastoral team, he's like the behaviour guy who goes round throwing his weight around a bit. And is there a kind, warm, open man there for boys to talk to when they have problems? I think we need to provide care for male self-harm. As I said earlier, a kid punches a wall, and it does happen all the time, especially around when they get to 16. I mean, they're punching walls at parties, they're punching walls in school, and what they're doing is they're coming into school the next day after, they've had a party over the weekend, and they come into school and they're showing on their knuckles and wearing these bruises like trophies. And actually punching a wall, or even other self-destructive behaviours, fronting up to a teacher, fighting on the playground. I think we need to, of course these things need to be sanctioned, but also we need to consider, what if this is a form of self-harm? I think we need to harness the benefits of physical exercise. I think speaking to PE teachers, still too many kids are getting away with just not doing PE because they don't want to. And they forged the note. I think we really need to think carefully about how we can get all children involved in physical exercise at school. I think that probably means providing a broader range of activities in PE. I know PE teachers are doing an amazing job out there, but I'm sure that still in some schools, the provision is limited to football, rugby and netball. I hear of schools doing yoga and orienteering. I think that's brilliant. I think we need to think more carefully about how we can get more boys and girls involved in physical exercise. I think we need to eradicate homophobia. That's a huge one. So I think it's 60% of gay or bisexual boys have considered taking their own lives. It's not 60% of gay or bisexual boys, that's 60% of gay or bisexual children. So, again, I think teachers need to, I think there need to be more LGBT plus clubs in school. I think that heterosexual teachers, as well as gay teachers, bisexual teachers, could stand and put themselves out there as advocates or role models for this kind of initiative. I think still there is a problem with language and using gay in the pejorative sense. I still think much more needs to be done about that as well. It's all there. It's all there in the book. We need to talk with boys using their language. So a lot of the time what we say is that the boys aren't speaking about their mental health, but actually I think maybe they are, that oftentimes we're just not listening. So there was a study in Australia in which they asked a group of men who had either attempted suicide or were clinically depressed, and asked them, when you tried to kill yourself, or when you are having a real, real down day during a period of depression, what kind of language do you use to convey that fact to your friends? And they were saying things like, oh, I'm stressed, or I'm tired. Okay. Whereas women are much more likely to say, I'm really anxious, or I think I might be depressed. Whereas men are using kind of, often it's language to do with work. I've just had enough of it today, or I'm a bit stressed. And boys use these things all the time. They say, oh, I'm tired. I've had enough. I'm just feeling a bit stressed out at the moment. And actually, these are kind of acceptable male ways of conveying that actually there's a deeper underlying issue. So we need to listen out for the fact that boys, actually, they might be speaking to us.
No, absolutely. Just moving into chapter 6 now, Matt, if we can. So chapter 6 is on sex and sexism, and the stories at the start of the chapter paint quite a depressing picture about the harassment that female teachers face daily. So what does the research say in the area of sex and sexism?
Interestingly, this is the chapter that people seem not to want to talk about. And yet for me, it's the most shocking in terms of what's in there. You know, so in 2017, the Women's Inequalities Committee, they found that almost a third of girls have experienced unwanted sexual touchiness. There's another report by UK Feminista. They found that 59% of girls have experienced sexual harassment at school. And yet, quite depressingly, only 6% of students who have witnessed or experienced sexual harassment at school have actually reported it to a teacher. So if 59% have experienced it, but only 6% of this 59% are actually reporting it. Because people think it's acceptable, it's just what happens at school. Boys grope you, boys wolf whistle at you, boys talk about masturbation to the point it makes you feel uncomfortable. They just do it, and that's just a done thing. And also it's embarrassing, of course, isn't it, to go and talk to a teacher that you're feeling uncomfortable about that sort of thing. I mean, 29% of teachers say that sexist language is a regular daily occurrence. 29%, that's huge. And I bet you 29% of teachers, I bet you 100% of those aren't reporting it. That's speculation. I just think there needs to be more clarity. I think teachers don't know exactly what constitutes sexual harassment in school. It's not just groping, wolf whistling. Like I say, making crass jokes about sex, giggling about innuendos, making other people feel uncomfortable. It happens all the time. And I think because it happens so often, teachers become immune to it. It becomes normalized. But actually, what schools need to do is they need to be clear, and you know, there needs to be a policy. Increasingly in schools, we're finding, you know, there are policies on what constitutes homophobia, there are policies on what constitutes racism, but I don't see so much policies laying out exactly what constitutes sexual harassment in schools. Because it's very easy to do. You can actually just list, this is, and in fact, the D of E have already done it. In 2018, they released, it's in the book, I can't remember, but they actually published a set of guidelines, literally outlining exactly what constitutes sexual harassment in schools. So, lewd comments, that is sexual harassment, okay? But I bet lewd comments happen all the time in lessons with some students in some schools, and nothing happens. So, and I've actually spoken to teachers and said, look, this is what you need to do. But they're uncomfortable with it. I don't know why, but certainly schools need to be looking at these guidelines, releasing a policy, sending a letter home so that everybody's clear on it, and then teachers are clear on it. And then the next time the girl feels uncomfortable when someone makes a paedophile joke, or next time someone, you know, grabs someone by the balls, then, you know, or on their private parts, then all of a sudden a kid knows that that is wrong, and they can report it to a teacher, and the teacher can see that it's wrong, and they can sort it out.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And yeah, if you want to have a look at that, like you said, the evidence and the research is very clearly outlined in that chapter, isn't it, in chapter 6. So for people who haven't got the book, and you know, that's definitely worth delving into a little bit more detail in terms of, you know, how to do that as a leader in school. So moving into chapter 8 now, Matt, if we can. So this starts with one of my favourite stories here. So this is a lovely segue from a quite a very serious topic into quite a personal story. But, you know, this really resonated with me as a kind of, you know, a male teacher, I suppose. So in chapter 8 on violence, you tell us a story about the remnants of a half-eaten kebab. So just tell us a little bit more about that story.
Yeah, it was just one of those moments of kind of masculine impotency that I think all men feel. So it's a true story about when I think I was 15, 16 years old in a kebab shop, eating a kebab. And the first of many, I hasten to add. Eating a kebab, and three lads about 2 or 3 years older than me, they're in upper sixth, came in and just took the piss out, basically. One of them kept flicking my ears as well. It just made me feel horrible, really. I didn't put it in the book, but I mean, I sat there after they'd left, crying my eyes out, and then I went home. And then I left the house, and I stalked the streets for hours trying to find them, thinking when I see them, I'm going to sort them out, all three of them. Never mind the fact that they're all 2 stone heavier than me, and you know, twice as big as me. I'm going to sort them out. And I never did find them that night. And probably I didn't actually want to. But, you know, for years afterwards, it's always plagued me. I still see these boys around. Well, they're not boys anymore, but I still have to walk past them in the street. And I've often felt that actually, I went to bed that night safe. I hadn't had my head kicked in, you know, because if I'd found these boys, they would have killed me. So I went to bed a little bit embarrassed. My pride had been broken, but my face was all right. But I still felt like a failure. And I said somewhere else recently, at the time, I would have rather gone to bed in a hospital bed, bruised and broken, but having done something, having stuck up for myself, rather than go to bed safe and as I did, because I just sat there and just let them humiliate me in front of everybody. And it's a tough one, these moments, because you feel emasculated. And there's a guy called Dr. Anthony Ellis. He's written a book, I think it's called Masculinities and Violence. And he talks about the very real fact that for many men that endure these moments of humiliation where they feel that they have not acted as a man should, later on in life, they will try to atone for those moments. And I don't want to talk about it too much, but certainly I feel that later on in life, there were times when maybe I conducted myself in ways that I shouldn't, because I was still ruminating on that moment and the moment somebody humiliated me and I just took it. It's a funny one.
It really it is, and every man who's reading that will have a story like that, and it resonated, you know, with me, and I can think of exactly the time when that happened to me. But I mean, in terms of sharing it, I'll share it very, very quickly. So I'd gone from being sort of hero to, you know, massively zero within the space of about half an hour. So, you know, these stories often revolve around football. So scores winning goal in, you know, game against school that was next door. This is the 1980s, you know, so I'm a bit older. Yeah. But, you know, they didn't have anything like, you know, security fences or anything between the two schools. So you score the goal, you come out like a hero, you're with your mates. Then three of the next door school jump on you at the end of the day as you walk out the front of the school. The rest of your mates disappear pretty lively and you get, you know, a rather good hiding. And fortunately, for one of the things about the 1980s was that people would intervene and they weren't scared of the consequences. So fortunately, yeah. You know, a car driving past, you know, a sort of an older gentleman got out and shooed him away. But yeah, exactly as you felt, you just feel like running through that in your mind, how you could do it differently, what kind of things you'd do next time, yeah. How you would do that. And then having to live with that, coming back into school from what should have been the best day of school coming in, to actually the worst day. And I often think about it now in terms of, you know, because I'm a father of a secondary school age pupil now. So, you know, thinking about what kind of things would I share out of that. And I think that chapter on that really, really helped sort of crystallise my thinking there.
Would you say you're over it? I mean, you're educated now, you're a teacher, you're liberal and you're open-minded and we're having this discussion. Would you say you're over that humiliation or that emasculation?
Well, the fact that I can still remember it after what's going to be, in my case, it must be about exactly 30 years, says that probably not fully. I often thought that it maybe taught me the lesson that I needed to be taught, which is a strange way of thinking, that I'd become almost, you know, too big for my boots, which I don't think I particularly had. But yeah, no, it's certainly, I don't know, is the answer, I suppose. And it's becoming more of a thing because, you know, what advice do you give to your son in terms of, because you go on to talk about testosterone and testosterone being a complicated beast, and you think, what kind of advice do I now give to my son if he was to be in that kind of situation? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this testosterone thing is it's interesting, isn't it? It's like I think I call it testosterone is like, I can't remember, was it, I could say it was masculinity scapegoat or something, you know, this it's like a get out, you know, boys are just violent because of this thing called testosterone. But actually this whole testosterone thing, I think, yeah, I call it a fairy tale. We can't put testosterone, we can't reliably say that testosterone is responsible for male violence because, so what's her name? Cordelia Fine, she writes a brilliant book called, it's Testosterone Rex. And in it, she explains, I mean, the whole book is a dismantling of this testosterone myth, but so a few things that stuck out for me, but testosterone is quite an easy measure. We can, as I understand it, levels of testosterone are quite easy to measure. But it's kind of crude because there are other kind of processes in our biology that are far more difficult to measure. Things like our estrogen levels and the rate or the way in which it converts to testosterone, the number and nature of like various receptors in our body, how each of these receptors are sensitive and how sensitive they are and how that differs from person to person, etc. These are all things that are measurable but far less easy to measure, and so testosterone becomes kind of like the go-to. But actually, you know, the body's hormone system, or the endocrine system, like the body's hormonal system is a complex beast with so many different things happening at any one time. It's tough. I kind of think of that blaming testosterone for male violence is like blaming the news agent who sells matches for the fire that happens later. You know, those matches and the fact that this news agent has sold them is a factor, obviously, in the arson that happens later, but you would never say that he is responsible for the fire. Yeah, it's complicated. And there are loads of studies that, you know, for every study that, it's like anything in research, for every study that supports one argument, there's another that suggests otherwise. There's lots of studies that show that testosterone, rather than having an effect on our environment, actually our environment has an effect on testosterone levels. So for example, when men become fathers, their testosterone levels reduce. However, in tribes where paternal care is the norm, where where fathers are responsible for the rearing of the children, those men have a greater reduction in testosterone. So what's happening there is their cultural circumstances are affecting the testosterone levels and not the other way around. There are animal studies that show that testosterone levels in monkeys are different depending on the social status of that monkey, and they will change as that monkey either rises up the social status, the social hierarchy of that that tribe, or downwards. And it's not like the monkey, he gets a surge in testosterone and then he becomes leader of the pack. It's the other way around. He becomes leader of the pack and then his testosterone levels rise. So, I mean, Cordelia Fine, Testosterone Rex, is the person to go to on this. But yeah, I think we need to be beware of this testosterone myth.
So in terms of the chapter on violence, what advice do you give to school leaders and teachers in that area?
I think too often we react to violence. Well, that's it. We react to it. So violence happens and then a sanction takes place. But actually in schools where violence is a problem, there needs to be a proactive approach. There needs to be a whole school approach with a framework and a logic behind it, a program of education. And what I'm, yeah, I don't know whether this would happen in PSHE lessons or blocked off days over the course of a year, or as a kind of intervention thing with certain groups of students, but there needs to be considered and careful thought and craft into delivering a program. And it needs to be effectively delivered by teachers who are good at delivering it, just like in any subject. It needs to be relevant. The research shows that these kind of programs, these violent prevention programs, do work. They have been shown to have a positive impact on reducing violence in communities, but it does need to be relevant. So there's no point, there's no point doing a violence prevention program that focuses on knife crime or gang culture if you're working in a school where there's never been a stabbing in the community. There needs to be it needs to be relevant, and it needs to be evaluated as well, just like any program of instruction. But yeah, certainly I think that schools need to be thinking about putting in place a scheme of work on violence prevention. And there's loads of literature on that. I think in the book I actually include an example program. I think it's 6 or 7 lessons that people could follow. But I also, in the book, there's a link to some of the work done by a guy called Dr. Michael Flood and some other institutions who you can just go onto their websites and download whole schemes of work about violence prevention programs.
Yeah. And it's a fascinating chapter and it's a fascinating book. So we've whipped through this pretty quickly. I'm going to move into the last chapter, if that's okay. So in the last chapter, What Next? You talk about, or you tell readers that years of gender socialisation cannot be undone by reading your book. But we've all made a positive change by picking up the book. So what next then for school leaders or NQTs or just teachers in general?
I think there just needs to be an ongoing reflection and discussion. I know for lots of people this book is a catalyst, and it started something. Some schools, some teachers I've spoken to are basing whole CPD programs off the back of it, and that's brilliant. But what I really like is when teachers come to me and say, after reading your book, I've stopped saying man up to my kids, or now I've read your book, I actually talk about masculinity in Romeo and Juliet and not just how Juliet's mistreated. Now I've read your book, I think a lot more carefully about how we set kids. And I've noticed that we're putting all the boys, particularly boys from disadvantaged backgrounds, in bottom sets. And so now my school are changing that. That's what I like. I think that's the next step, is to keep reflecting and to just to keep thinking and keep the discussion going. Because there are a whole host of people out there who have read this book that want to talk about it. Keep thinking and adapting and tweaking your practice. It doesn't have to be a whole school thing. We wrote the book very aware that actually a lot of the teachers reading it don't have the power to just do a whole school change, you know. And we say in the book that, you know, at the end of the day, the classroom is your kingdom. Your classroom is where you rule. And, you know, if the scheme of work says that just because, you know, you've got a boy heavy class, I hate that phrase, boys heavy, but, and so you're going to do war poetry, well, actually, no. Tell them you're doing war poetry, but don't. All right, show them poetry about love and feelings and kind, if you want to, if you feel that that's the right thing to do. So I'm hoping that people just use it as a kind of a confidence booster, you know, to keep going and keep reflecting and keep chatting.
Well, I mean, in terms of my own practice, and, you know, this podcast for me is the best kind of CPD, because I'm fortunate I get to speak to great people like yourself about this. And I just think about my own practice, and I'm sure that listeners will be, you know, thinking about reflecting on theirs. But, you know, I've had some of those classes, as you described, as kind of boy heavy. And my approach has sometimes been to use humour and perhaps to use humour in a way that, you know, I hesitate to say this because I don't want to be criticising my own practice on a podcast, but,
no,
you know, that could be seen to put myself at the forefront of the class as the alpha male and squash one or two.
Oh, mate,
and I think now...
we've all done it.
I think, I mean, I no doubt I probably will at some point, but I feel now as if maybe it's because I'm getting a bit older, or maybe it's because, you know, you're a parent yourself now, maybe it's just... And certainly with reading this, I just think I'm doing less of that. And actually, I'm not needing to do as much of that. I'm quite happy to be open to things that I like that wouldn't necessarily be stereotypically male, or things that, ways of behaving, ways of acting, and be unapologetic about that. So I think it's had a real impact in terms of me considering how I go about things.
Good. I'm glad.
So in terms of just finishing off a little bit, if we can, so I know you're in massive demand in terms of coming and speaking at CPD sessions, and I was just going to share another one, an anecdote with you. I mean, I go down to quite a lot of research ed events, and it's always good to see when people are on the way down to research ed, you can see who's coming, because your book pops up everywhere. So I went to a lot of research ed events last year, and I thought, I'm in good company on train carriages when Boys Don't Try pops up, because it's quite a distinctive cover, isn't it, in terms of its colouring. And you think, here we go. So there's lots of people doing that. So just tell us a little bit more about where you'll be speaking coming up soon, and maybe where people can find a little bit more about maybe booking you to speak somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, if people want to book me to speak, they just need to get in touch on Twitter, and I'll try my best to make it happen. But the next, what are we doing? So Mark and I guess the next big event, at the top of my head, that we're doing is Research Ed Durrington. It's normally at the end of April. That's Sean Allison and Andy Carby arranged that one. So Research Ed Durrington. and then after that, it all just goes crazy. We've applied for the Festival of Education. We're doing some stuff up in Leeds. I'm doing Research Ed Telford. I'll be doing Research Ed Kent again. Hopefully they'll invite me back at Surrey. So yeah, we like to spread the message and flog a few more books. So if people are at us, we'll be there.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Matt, for tonight. Really appreciate you giving up your time in your holiday to speak to us. Really enjoyed the book, and Yeah, hopefully, you know, we'll get a chance to bump into you at one of these events at some point during the next year.
Cool, yeah, thanks, man. And, yeah, thanks for putting up with my... Sorry, I've had this terrible cough. I hope it hasn't impeded on proceedings too much.
Not at all, not at all. Thanks, thanks again.
Okay, take care, mate.
Cheers.
Nailers, Natter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Nailers, Natter, just talking to teachers.
So this week on the podcast pedagogy section, I am looking at What They Didn't Teach Me on My PGCE by Sarah Mullin. And this is one of the most comprehensive, well-researched and fantastically practical books that I've had the pleasure to read. And the author has all the credibility and experience you would expect for a work of this quality. Sarah has moved from being an English teacher to head of English, from assistant head to deputy head. And the insight and experience allows her to talk with other teachers and bring the reader a collection of narratives in a range of genres and styles from professionals at all stages of their career. And what I liked about this book, and this is ideal for me in terms of the busy day-to-day life of a deputy head teacher, you can dip in and out of this, which is perfect, as I said. So chapters will inspire you to research more, and they also will pinpoint other areas for further study should you want to go deeper. And there's 13 chapters on topics such as behaviour management, childhood trauma, but also a fantastically practical one on acronyms and one on modelling as well. So these 13 chapters are full of pearls of wisdom, funny stories and good solid advice from a diverse range of teachers plucked from the Twitter sphere. And the biggest thing that I think that teachers will get from this is a feeling that they're not alone and they have a sense of belonging, and it can help support new and experienced teachers and help you reflect healthily on your own practice. So this is a great book, and I'm going to have the pleasure of speaking to Sarah fairly soon on a future Nailers Natter. So that's What They Didn't Teach Me on My PGCE by Sarah Mullin, and that's available everywhere now.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
So moving into the shameless plug section, and there are fewer and fewer of these at the moment. So we have Research Ed Birmingham, and we have Research Ed Blackpool, of course. We also have Research Ed Rugby up on the horizon. So thank you to Jude Hunton for inviting me back to that. So I'm really looking forward to going back there. Last week I started a section which was sort of teacher life and teacher five a day, where I was advocating getting out and about and doing some activities. So as you know, quite a fan of the park run. So if you can get to one of those on a Saturday morning, very, very good for your physical health, and it's good in terms of meeting other people and having a chat on a Saturday morning. I did manage to get out and watch a film this week, so if you get a chance to go and watch The Gentleman, which I personally enjoyed very, very much, and it was a Guy Ritchie back to form film, so check that out. And also on the music front this week, I have a little bit of a change of tack from last week's recommendation on Jerry Cinnamon. So this week I have been listening to the sounds of Hans Zimmer and his soundtracks. So, yeah, read into that what you will. Okay, so coming up next week on the podcast, we have Sam Strickland, aka the Strickomaster, talking about his new book, which will be out at the end of next week. So that's a great interview, really practical, chock full of advice that you can take away from the podcast. And I also have future podcasts lined up with Tom Rogers and Sam Twistleton. So again, as ever, just remains to say thank you very much for listening to Nailers Natter, and speak to you again next week.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.